Chapter 11. Momum. Reason, Agensis writes, is the capacity to overcome unprecedented obstacles in the gratification of desire. What distinguishes man from beasts is man's capacity to overcome infinite obstacles through reason. But Agensis has confused the accidental for the essential. Prior to the capacity to overcome infinite obstacles is the capacity to confront them. What defines man is not that he reasons, but that he prays. Ecyanus 1, 44 Epistles. Late Winter, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Momum. Prince Nerse Proyas of Conraya stumbled, then steadied himself as his men rowed the boat through the breakers. He'd resolved to come to the beaches of Nansorium standing, but the Menenor, which had resolved to pound the coasts until all the world was sea, was making things difficult. Twice now, frothing walls of surf had almost tossed him overboard, and he found himself debating the wisdom of his resolution. He scanned the sand-barren shoreline, saw that only the standard of Atrempus occupied the immediate beach, and decided that arriving dry and sitting was far better than arriving half-drowned. The holy war at last. But as profoundly as this thought moved him, it was accompanied by a certain apprehension. He'd been the first to kiss Mathenet's knee at Sumna, and now he was certain he would be the last of the great names to join the holy war. Politics, he thought sourly. It was not, as the philosopher Agensis had written, the negotiation of advantage within communities of men. It was more an absurd auction than an exercise in oratory. One bartered principle and piety to accomplish what principle and piety demanded. One sullied himself in order to be cleansed. Proyas had kissed Mathenet's knee, had committed himself to the course that faith and principle demanded of him. The god himself had sanctioned this course. But from the outset, it had been mired in politics, the endless wrangling with the king, his father, the infuriating delays involved in assembling the fleet, the innumerable concessions, contracts, preemptive strikes, retaliatory strikes, flatteries and threats, a soul sold, it seemed, in order to be saved. Has this been your test? Have you found me wanting? Even the voyage at sea had been a trial. Always fickle, the Menenor was especially tempestuous in winter. Struck by a storm off the coasts of Syrange and driven out of the Menenor altogether, forced by unfavorable winds to venture dangerously close to heathen coasts, at one point they had been mere days from Shima itself, or so his fool navigator had told him, as though the irony would thrill rather than gall him. Then the second storm, as they laboriously tacked north, the one that had scattered the fleet and robbed more than 500 men of their lives. At every turn, it seemed, something must conspire against him. If not men, then the elements, and if not the elements, then men. Even his dreams had tormented him, that the holy war had already marched, that he would arrive, share a bowl of wine with the emperor, then be told to go home. Perhaps he should have expected this. Perhaps meeting a Commian in Sumna, while kneeling before Mathenet no less, had been more than an outrageous coincidence. Perhaps it had been an omen, a reminder that the gods often laughed where men gnashed their teeth. Just then, an immense roller tipped the boat forward and doused its occupants with foaming, sun-flashing water. Like an acorn across silk, the keel slid sideways along the back of a wave. Several of the rowers cried out. For a moment, it seemed certain they would founder. One of the oars was lost. Then the boat scraped up and across immovable sand, and they found themselves stranded in the midst of several tidal pools. Proyas leapt out with his men and, against their protests, helped them drag the launch farther up onto the bone-white beach. He glimpsed his fleet scattered across the bright sea. It seemed impossible. They were here. They had arrived. As the others began retrieving the gear, Proyas walked several paces inland and fell to his knees. The sand burned his skin. The wind rifled his short jet hair. The air smelled of salt, fish, and burning stone. Not so different, he thought, from the smell of Kunraya's distant coast. It's begun, sweet prophet. The holy war has begun. Let me be the font of your righteous fury. Let my hand be the hand that delivers your hearth from wickedness. Let me be your hammer. Sheltered by the ambient thunder of the breakers, it seemed safe to weep. He blinked tears from his eyes. In his periphery, he could see the men who had awaited him approach across the white slopes. He cleared his throat, stood as they neared, absently brushing the sand from his tunic. Beneath the flapping standard of a trempas, they fell to their knees, and with their hands turned inward upon their thighs, bowed their heads before him. A low escarpment framed them, and beyond that, a great gray smear across the sky. Momum, Proya supposed, and her innumerable fires. I actually missed you, Zynemus, Proya said. What do you make of that? The burly, thick-bearded man at the forefront stood. Not for the first time, Proyas was struck by how much he resembled a Kamian. I'm afraid, my lord prince, Zynemus replied, that your kind sentiment will be short-lived. He hesitated. That is, once you hear the news I bear you. Already it begins. Months ago, before he'd returned to Kunraya to raise his army, Mathenet had warned him that House Ikuri would likely cause the Holy War grief. But Zynemus's demeanor told him that something far more dramatic than mere politicking had transpired in his absence. I've never been one to begrudge the messenger, Zynemus, you know that. He momentarily studied the faces of the marshal's retinue. Where's that ass, Calmamunus? The dread in Zynemus's eyes could scarcely be concealed. Dead, my lord prince. Dead? He asked sharply. Please don't let it begin like this. He pursed his lips and asked more evenly, What has happened? Calmamunus marched. Marched? By the last I heard, he lacked the provisions. I sent a letter to the emperor himself, asking him to deny Calmamunus anything he might need to march. Please, not like this. When the emperor denied him provisions, Calmamunus and the others rioted, even sacked several villages. They hoped to march against the heathen on their own so they might garner all the glory. I very nearly came to blows with the damned. Calmamunus marched? Proyas felt numb. The emperor provisioned him? As I see it, my lord prince, Calmamunus gave the emperor precious little choice. He's always known how to incite men, Calmamunus. It was either provision and be rid of him, or risk open war. The Holy Shrier would have interceded before then, Proya snapped, unwilling to acquit anyone of this crime. Calmamunus marched, and now he's dead, do you mean to say? Yes, my lord prince, Zynemus said solemnly. He'd already digested these facts. The first battle of the Holy War has ended in catastrophe. They're all dead. Istratmeni, Gadafaris, all the pilgrim barons of Canamporia, along with countless thousands of others, have been destroyed by the heathen at a place called the Plains of Mengeda. As far as I know, only some 30 or so Galioth from Thar Shilka's contingent survived. But how could this be? The Holy War overcome in battle? Only 30? How many marched? More than 100,000. The first of the Galioth to arrive, in the first Ainoni, along with the hosts of rabble that descended on Momum shortly after the Shrier's call. The rumbling crash and hiss of surf filled the silence. The Holy War, or a sizable fraction of it, had been slaughtered. Are we doomed? Can the heathen be that strong? What does the Shrier say? He asked, hoping to silence these dread premonitions. The Shrier has fallen silent. Gotian says that he's gone into mourning for the souls lost at Mengeda. But there's rumor that he's become frightened the Holy War will be unable to overcome the heathen, that he waits for a sign from the god, and the sign does not come. And the Emperor? What does he say? The Emperor has claimed all along that the men of the Tusk underestimate the ferocity of the heathen. He mourns the loss of the vulgar holy war.
Of the what?
That's what it's come to be called, because of the rabble. A shameful relief accompanied this explanation. When it became evident that the dregs, old men, women, even orphaned children, would answer the Shrya's call, Proyas had actually worried that the campaign would be more a migration than an army. The Emperor publicly mourns, Zynemus continued, but privately insists that no war against the heathen, holy or otherwise, can succeed without the leadership of his nephew, Confis. Emperor or not, the man is a mercenary dog. Proyas nodded, finally grasping the outline of the events confronting him. And I suppose the price he demands for the great Aikuri Confis is nothing other than his indenture, hm? That wretched Kalmamunus has sold us all. I tried, my lord. I tried to restrain the Palatine, but I'd neither the rank nor the wit to stay him. No man has wit enough to reason with a fool, Zin, and you're not to blame for your rank. Kalmamunus was an arrogant, impetuous man. In the absence of his betters, he no doubt became drunk with conceit. He doomed himself, Zin. It's as simple as that. But it was not, Proyas knew, quite that simple. The Emperor had a hand in this. Of that much he was certain. But still, Zynemus said, I cannot help feeling there's more I could have done. Proyas shrugged. Saying I could have done more, Zin, is what marks a man as a man and not a god. He snorted ruefully. Actually, it was a Carmian who told me that. Zynemus smiled wanly. And me as well. A most wise fool, that Akamian. And wicked. A blasphemer. How I wish you'd remember that, Zin. A wise fool indeed. Seeing their prince safely arrived, the rest of the Kunrayan host had begun to disembark from the fleet. Looking out to the Menenor, Proyas saw more launches swept ashore by the rough surf. Soon these beaches would be choked with men, his men, and they could very well be doomed. Why, God, why beleaguer us when it's your will we seek to accomplish? He spent some time grilling Zynemus on the particulars of Kalmamunus's defeat. Yes, Kalmamunus was most certainly dead. The Phanum had sent his severed head as a message. No one knew for sure how the heathens had destroyed them. The survivors, Zynemus said, had reported that the heathen were beyond numbering, that they possessed at least 2 men for every Inrithi. But the survivors of a great defeat, Proyas knew, were prone to say such things. Proyas felt afflicted by endless questions, each so desperate to be uttered that he often interrupted Zynemus mid-reply. And he felt afflicted, moreover, with a curious sense of having been deceived, as though his time in Kunraya and at sea had been the result of another's machinations. He was unaware of the approaching imperial retinue until it was nearly upon him.
Confis himself, Zynemus said grimly, nodding across the beach, has come to woo you, my prince.
Though he'd never met him, Proyas recognized Aikuri Confis immediately. The man's bearing conveyed a palpable sense of the Nansor imperial tradition, the godlike equanimity of his expression, the martial familiarity of the way he held his silvered helmet under his right arm. The man was even able to walk through sand with cat-like grace. Confis smiled when their eyes met, the smile of heroes who'd hitherto encountered each other only in rumor and reputation. Then he stood before him, the near-mythic man who had mastered the Skilvendi. Proyas found it difficult not to be impressed, even faintly awed by his presence. Bowing slightly at the waist and holding out his hand for a soldier's shake, Confis said,
In the name of Aikuri Zorias III, the Emperor of Nansur, I welcome you, Prince Nersei Proyas, to our shores and to the Holy War.
Your shores. Would that it were your Holy War as well.
Proyas neither bowed nor took the proffered hand. Rather than displaying shock or insult, Confis's eyes became at once ironic and appraising.
I fear, he continued easily, that recent events have made it difficult for us to trust each other.
Where is Gotian? Proyas asked.
The Grand Master of the Shrial Knights awaits you on the escarpment. He does not like sand in his boots.
And you?
I was wise enough to wear sandals.
There was laughter at this, enough to make Proyas grind his teeth. When Proyas said nothing, Confis continued.
Calmamunus, I understand, was your man. It isn't surprising that you should seek to blame others rather than your own, but let me assure you, the Palatine of Canampuria perished of his own folly.
Of that, exult general, I have no doubt.
Then you will accept the Emperor's invitation to join him on the Andiamine Heights?
To speak of his indenture, no doubt.
Among other matters.
I would speak with Gotian first.
So be it, my prince. But perhaps I might save you some wasted breath and tell you what the Grand Master will say. Gotian will tell you that the Most Holy Shrier holds your man, Calmamunus, solely responsible for the disaster on the plains of Mengeda, and he'll tell you that the Shrier has been deeply moved by this disaster, and that he now seriously ponders the Emperor's single and eminently justified demand. And it is, I assure you, justified. On the ancestor lists of every family of means in the Empire, you'll find the names of dozens who have died warring for the very lands that the Holy War would reconquer.
That may be, Ikuri, but it is we who lay down our lives this time.
The Emperor understands and appreciates this, which is why he has offered to grant title to the lost provinces, under the auspices of the Empire, of course.
It is not enough.
No, I suppose it's never enough, is it? I admit, my prince, that we find ourselves in a most curious predicament. Unlike you, the House Ikuri is not known for its piety. And now that we're at last defending a just cause, we find ourselves impugned for our past deeds. But the scandal of the arguer has no bearing on the truth or falsehood of his arguments. Is this not what Agensis himself tells us? I urge you, Prince, to see past our flaws and scrutinize our demand in the sweet light of reason.
And if reason tells me otherwise?
Why then, you have the example of Calmamunus to live by, don't you? As much as it might pain you to admit, the Holy War needs us.
Once again, Proyas made no reply. Confis continued with a heavy-lidded smile.
So you see, Nerse Proyas, both reason and circumstance are on our side.
When Proyas still refused to reply, the exalt general bowed, then turned with casual disdain. Followed by his shimmering retinue, he receded across the beach. The breakers clamored with renewed fury, and the wind whipped a fine spray across Proyas and his men. It was chill. Proyas did his best to conceal his shaking hands. In the battle for the Holy War, a skirmish had just been fought, and Ikuri Confis had bested him before his own, with ease no less. All his troubles so far, Proyas knew, would be but gnats compared with the exalt general and his thrice-damned uncle.
Come, Zynemus, he said absently. We must ensure the fleet disembarks in good order.
There's one other thing, my prince, something I forgot to mention.
Proyas sighed deeply, was troubled by the audible tremor that passed through it.
What is it now, Zin?
Drusus Acamion is here.
Acamion sat alone by the fire, waiting for Zynemus's return. Save for a handful of slaves and passing men of the Tusk, the camp about him was abandoned. The marshal's men were still on the beaches, Acamion knew, helping their prince and their kinsmen disembark. The sense of surrounding canvas hollows troubled him. Dark and empty tents, cold fire pits. This was what it would be like, he realized, if the marshal and his men were destroyed on the battlefield. Abandoned belongings, places where words and looks had once warmed the air.
Absence.
Acamion shuddered. The first few days after joining Zynemus and the Holy War, Acamion had busied himself with matters concerning the Scarlet Spires. He placed a series of wards about his tent, discreetly, so as not to offend Enrithi sensibilities. He found a local man to show him the way to the villa where the Scarlet Schoolmen were sequestered. He made maps, lists of names. He even hired three adolescent brothers, the children of a non-hereditary Shigeki slave owned by a Taidoni thane, to watch the track leading to the villa to report on significant comings and goings. There was little else for him to do. His single attempt to ingratiate himself with the local magnate the Spires had contracted to provision them had been a disaster. When a Kamiyan persisted, the man had literally tried to stab him with a spoon, not out of any sense of loyalty to the Spires, but out of terror. The Nansor, it seemed, were learning quickly. For the Scarlet Schoolmen, any cause for suspicion, be it a bead of sweat or familiarity with a stranger, was tantamount to betrayal. And no one betrayed the Scarlet Spires. But all these tasks were little more than routine. The entire time a Kamiyan would think, "After this, Inro, I'll tend to you after this." Then, after came. There was no one to question, no one to watch, no one save Mathanet to even suspect. There was nothing to do but wait. Of course, according to the reports he sent his mandate handlers in at Yersis, he was aggressively pursuing this hint or that innuendo. But that was simply part of the pantomime all of them, even zealots like Nozera, played. They were like starving men dining on grass. When one starved, why not cultivate the illusion of digestion? But this time, the illusion sickened rather than soothed. The reason seemed obvious enough. Inrau. By falling into the hole that was the consult, Inrau had made it too deep to be papered over. So a Kamiyan began hunting for ways to deaden his heart, or at the very least, to crowd some of the recriminations from his thoughts. "When Proyas comes," he would tell his dead student, "I'll tend to you when Proyas comes." He took to heavy drink, unwatered wine mostly, some anpoi when Zynemus was in a particularly good mood, and yursa, a dreadful liquor the Galioth made from rotten potatoes. He smoked poppy oil and hashish, but he abandoned the former after the boundary between the trances and the dreams collapsed. He began rereading the few classics Zynemus had brought with him. He laughed over Agensis's third and fourth analytics, realizing for the first time the subtlety of the philosopher's sense of humor. He frowned at the lyrics of Protathus, finding them overwrought, even though they had seemed to speak his soul's own tongue 20 years earlier. And he started, as he had many times, the sagas, only to set them aside after a few hours. Either their florid inaccuracies made him furious to the point of huffing breath and shaking hands, or their truths made him weep. It was a lesson, it seemed, that he must relearn every few years. Seeing the apocalypse made it impossible to read accounts of it. Some days, when he was too restless to read, he ranged through the encampment, into warrens and down byways so segregated from the greater holy war that Norsarai openly called him a pick because of his skin. Once, 5 Taidoni chased him from their petty fief with knives, hollering slurs and accusations. Other days he wandered through Momum's mud-brick canyons, to different agoras, to the ancient temple complex of Camiro, and once to the gates of the imperial precincts. Inevitably, he found himself in the company of whores, even though he never remembered setting out to find them. He forgot faces, ignored names. He reveled in the heave of grunting bodies, in the greasiness of skin wiping unwashed skin. Then he wandered home, emptied of everything but his seed. He would try very hard not to think of Esme. Ordinarily, Zynemus returned in the evening, and they made time for a few moves in their running game of Benjuka. Then they sat by the marshal's fire, passed a sharp bowl of a drink that the Kunryans called Parapta, and insisted cleansed the palate for dinner, but that a Kamiyan thought made everything taste like fish. Then they dined on whatever Zynemus's slaves could scrounge. Some nights they would be joined by the marshal's officers, usually Dinchazes, Zenkapa, and Arissus, and their time would consist of ribald jokes and irreverent gossip. Other nights it would be just the two of them, and they would speak of deeper and more painful things. Occasionally, like this night, a Kamiyan found himself alone. Word of the Conryan fleet had arrived before dawn. Zynemus had left shortly after to prepare for the Crown Prince's arrival. His temper had been short because he dreaded, Achaemenid had no doubt, informing Proyas of Calmamunus and the Vulgar Holy War. When Achaemenid had suggested the possibility of accompanying him to meet Proyas, Zynemus had simply stared at him incredulously and barked, "He's going to hang me as it is!" Before departing, however, he rode up to the morning fire and promised Achaemenid he would let Proyas know of his presence and of his need. The day had been long with hope and dread. Proyas was Mathanet's friend and confidant. If anyone could coax information from the Holy Shrya, it would be him. And why shouldn't he? So much of what he was, of what made others refer to him as the Sun Prince, was due to his old tutor, to Drusus Achaemenid. "Don't worry, Inrao. He owes me." Then the sun fell without word from Zynemus. Doubt took hold, as did drink. Fear hollowed his unspoken declarations, so he filled them with anger and spite. "I made him what he is, he wouldn't dare." He repented these harsh thoughts and began to reminisce. He remembered Proyas as a boy, weeping, cradling his arm, running through the gloom of the walnut grove, through lances of sunlight. "Climb into books, you fool," he had shouted. "Their branches never break." He remembered coming upon Inrao, unawares in the scriptorium, watching him draw, in the bored fashion of juvenile boys, a row of phalluses across an unspoiled sheet. "Practicing your letters, hm?" "My sons," he muttered to the fire. "My beautiful sons." Finally, he heard horsemen filing down the dark lanes. He saw Zynemus heading a small party of Conryan knights. The marshal dismounted in the shadows, then strode to the firelight, rubbing the back of his neck. His eyes had the weary look of a man with one last difficult task. "He'll not see you." "He must be incredibly busy," Achaemenid blurted, "and exhausted." "What a fool I was. Perhaps tomorrow." Zynemus sighed heavily. "No, Akka, he will not see you." Near the heart of Momim's famed Camposia Agora, Achaemenid paused at a stall of bronze wares. Ignoring the proprietor's scowl, he lifted a large polished plate, pretended to look for imperfections. He turned it from side to side, peered into the smeared reflection of the throngs passing behind him. Then he saw the man again, apparently haggling with a sausage seller. Clean-shaven, black hair chopped in the haphazard way of slaves. Wearing a blue linen tunic beneath a robe striped in the Nil-Nameshi fashion, Achaemenid glimpsed an exchange of coppers in the stall's shadow. The man's reflection turned into sunlight, holding a sausage pinched in bread. His bored eyes sifted through the teeming market, settling on this or that. He took a small bite, then glanced at Achaemenid's back. "Who are you?"
"What's this?" the bronze peddler cried. "You checking teeth for pepper?"
"For pox," Achaemenid said darkly. "I fear I might have the pox." He did not need to look at the man to know the horror those words would evoke. A woman lingering over the wine bowls quickly scuttled into the crowd. Achaemenid watched the reflected figure saunter from the stall. Though he doubted he was in any immediate danger, being followed was not something to be ignored. Odds were the man belonged to the Scarlet Spires, which would be interested in him for the obvious reasons, or perhaps even the Emperor, who spied on everyone for the sake of spying on everyone. But there was always the chance the man belonged to the College of Luthamay. If the Thousand Temples had killed Inrao, then they probably knew he was here. And if that was the case, Achaemenid needed to know what this man knew. Smiling, Achaemenid offered the plate to the bronze peddler, who flinched as though it were a burning coal. Achaemenid tossed it onto the gleaming stacks instead, drawing passing stares with a racket. "Let him think I argue." But if he were to confront the man, the question was more one of where than of how. The Kamposia was definitely not the place. Some alley, perhaps. Beyond the agora, Akamian saw a cohort of birds wheeling above the great domes of the Temple Zothe, whose silhouette loomed above the tenements hedging the north end of the market. East of the temple stood a towering scaffold strung by a web of ropes to a leaning obelisk, the emperor's latest gift to the temple complex of Chimeral. It was somewhat smaller, Akamian noted, than the obelisks rising in the smoke beyond. He jostled his way north through rumbling crowds and shouting vendors, looking for breaks between the buildings that might mark some rarely used exit from the market. The man he trusted still followed. He almost stumbled across a peacock, its broad fan of angry red eyes in full display. The Nansur thought the bird holy and allowed them to roam free in their cities. Then he glimpsed a woman sitting in the window of one of the nearer tenements and was momentarily reminded of Esmanette. If they know about me, then they know about her. All the more reason to seize the fool who followed him. At the north end of the market, he passed among paddocks cramped with sheep and pigs. He even saw an immense snorting bull, sacrificial victims to sell to the cultic priests of Chimeral, Akamian supposed. Then he found his alley, a narrow slot between mud-brick walls. He passed a blind man sitting before a trinket-cluttered mat and hastened into the humid dark. The whine of flies filled his ears. He saw piles of ash and greasy entrails amid dried bones and dead fish. The stench was guttural with rot, but he retreated to a point where he was sure the man would not immediately see him, and waited. The smell extorted a cough from him. He struggled to concentrate, rehearsing the contorted words of the cant he would use to snare his hunter. The difficulty of the thoughts behind them unnerved him, as they often did. He was always faintly incredulous of his ability to work sorcery, more so when days would pass without his uttering a significant cant, as in this case. But in his 39 years with a mandate, his abilities, at least in this regard, had never failed him. I'm a schoolman. He watched sunbright figures flit to and fro across the opening. Still no man. The muck had crept above the lip of his sandals and now slithered between his toes. The fish between his feet, he noted, trembled. He saw a maggot roll from an empty eye socket. This is madness. No fool is fool enough to follow someone here. He rushed from the alley, held his hand against the bleary sun in order to scan his corner of the market. The man was nowhere to be seen. I'm the fool. Was he even following me? Fuming, Akamian abandoned his search and hastened to purchase those things that had brought him into Momim in the first place. He had learned nothing of the Scarlet Spires, even less of Mathanet and the Thousand Temples, and Proyas still refused to meet with him. Since he could find no new books to read and Zynemus had taken to upbraiding him for his drunkenness, Akamian had decided to revisit an old passion of his. He would cook. All sorcerers had studied alchemy to some extent, and all alchemists, at least those worth their salt, knew how to cook. Zynemus thought that he degraded himself, that cooking was for women and slaves, but Akamian knew different. Zynemus and his officers would scoff until they tasted, and then they would accord him a quiet honor, as they would any other skilled practitioner of an ancient art. Finally, Akamian would be more than the blasphemous beggar at their table. Their souls might be imperiled, but at least their appetites would be gratified. But the duck, the leeks, curry, and chives were all forgotten when he glimpsed the man again, this time beneath the ramparts of the Gilgalic Gate in the crush to leave the city. He caught only a momentary glimpse of his profile, but it was the same man, same ragged hair, same threadbare robe. Without thinking, Akamian dropped his purchases. Now it's my turn to follow. He thought of Esme. Did they know he'd stayed with her in Sumna? I can't risk losing him, witnesses or no witnesses. This was the kind of hasty action that Akamian ordinarily despised, but over the years he'd found that circumstances were unkind to elaborate plans, and that most everything deteriorated into such rash acts anyway.
You!
He shouted over the roar, then once again cursed himself for his stupidity. What if he fled? Obviously, he knew that a Kamian had spotted him. Otherwise, why wouldn't he have followed him into the alley? But luckily, the man hadn't heard. A Kamian doggedly worked his way toward him, glaring all the while at the back of his head. He was cursed, even viciously elbowed a couple of times as he shoved through the sweaty slots between people. But he remained intent on the man. The back of his head grew nearer.
Sweet Sejanus, man!
A perfumed Ainani cried in a Kamian's periphery.
Do that again and I'll fucking knife you!
Nearer. The cants of compulsion boiled through his thoughts. The others would hear, he knew. They would know. Blasphemy. What happens, happens. I need to take this man. Closer. Close enough. He reached out, grabbed his shoulder, and yanked him around. For a heartbeat, he could only stare at him speechlessly. The stranger scowled, shrugged a Kamian's hand away.
What's the meaning of this?
He spat. I apologize, a Kamian said hastily, unable to look away from his face. I thought you were someone else. But it was him, wasn't it? Had he seen the bruise of sorcery, he would have thought it a trick. But there was nothing, only a quarrelsome face. He had simply made a mistake. But how? The man appraised him for a contemptuous moment, then shook his head.
Drunken fool!
For a nightmarish moment, a Kamian could only stumble along with the crowd. He cursed himself for dropping his food. No matter. Cooking was for slaves anyway. Esmanette sat alone by Sarcellus's fire, shivering. Once again, she felt as though she'd been thrown beyond the circuit of what was possible. She had journeyed to find a sorcerer, only to be rescued by a knight. And now she found herself staring across the innumerable campfires of a holy war. When she squinted, peered over Momum, she could even see the Emperor's palace, the Andiamine Heights, rising against the murky sea. The sight made her cry, not only because she finally witnessed the world she had yearned to see for so long, but also because it reminded her of the tales she used to tell her daughter. The ones Esmanette would continue telling long after she had fallen asleep. She had always been a bad one for that, giving selfish gifts. The camp of the Shrial Knights occupied the heights to the north of Momum and above the Holy War, along terraced slopes that had once been cultivated. Because Sarcellus was first knight commander, second only to Inkiri Gotian, his pavilion dwarfed those of his men. It had been pitched as per his order, at the edge of the terrace, so that Esmanette might marvel over the sights to which he delivered her. Two blonde slave girls sat on a reed mat nearby, quietly eating rice and muttering to one another in their mother tongue. Esmanette had already caught them nervously glancing in her direction, as though fearful she concealed some hunger they had not gratified. They had bathed her, rubbed fine oils into her skin, and dressed her in blue muslin and silk gowns. She found herself hating them for fearing her, and yet loving them too. She could still taste the peppered pheasant they had prepared for her dinner. Do I dream? She felt a fraud, a whore who was also a mummer, and so twice damned, twice degraded, but she felt an overweening pride as well, terrifying because of its deranged conceit. This is me, something within her cried. Me! As I truly am. Sarcellus had told her it would be like this. How many times had he apologized for the discomforts of the road? He traveled frugally, bearing crucial correspondence for Inkiri Gotian, the Grand Master of the Shrial Knights. But he insisted this would change when they reached the Holy War, where he promised to keep her in a fashion befitting her beauty and her wit.
It'll be like the light after a long darkness, he had said. It will illuminate, and it will blind.
She ran a trembling palm along the brocaded silk that spilled across her lap. In the firelight, she could not see the tattoo on the back of her left hand. I like this dream. Breathless, she brought her wrist to her lips, tasted the bitterness of perfumed oil.
Fickle whore, remember why you're here.
She turned her left hand to the fire slowly, as though to dry it of sweat or dew, and watched the tattoo surface from the shadows between her tendons.
This is what I am,
an aging whore. And everybody knew what happened to old whores. Without warning, Sarcellus stepped from the darkness. He possessed, Esmonette had decided, a disturbing affinity to the night, as though he walked with rather than through it, and this despite his white shrial vestments. He paused, stared at her wordlessly.
He doesn't love you, you know. Not really.
She held his eyes across the firelight, breathed heavily.
Did you find him?
Yes. He's made camp with Conryans, as you said.
Part of her found his reluctance endearing.
But where, Sarcellus?
Near the Anseline Gate.
She nodded, looked away nervously.
Have you asked yourself why, Esme? If you owe me anything at all, you owe me this question.
Why him? Why a Kamian?
She had told him much about Akka, she realized. Too much. No man she'd ever met had been as inquisitive as Cutius Sarcellus, not even a Kamian. His interest in her was nothing short of ravenous, as though he found her tawdry life as exotic as she found his. And why not? House Cutius was one of the greater houses of the congregate. For someone like Sarcellus, suckled on honey and meat, coddled by slaves, experiences such as hers were as distant as faraway Zaum.
Ever since I can remember, he had confided to her, I've been drawn to the vulgar, to the poor, to those who provide the fat upon which my kind lives.
He chuckled.
My father used to cane me for playing number sticks with the field slaves, or for hiding in the scullery, trying to sneak peeks up skirts.
She smacked him playfully.
Men are dogs. The only difference is they sniff asses with their eyes.
He had laughed, exclaiming,
This is why I cherish your company so. To live a life like yours is one thing, but to be able to speak it, to share it, is another thing altogether. This is why I'm your devotee, Esme, your pupil.
How could she not be swept away? When she stared into his gorgeous eyes, with irises the brown of giving earth and whites like wetted pearls, she saw herself mirrored in a way she'd never dared imagine. She saw someone extraordinary, someone exalted rather than demeaned by her suffering. But now, watching him clench his fists in the firelight, she saw herself as cruel.
I told you, she said carefully. I love him.
Not you. Him. Esmonette could think of no two men more dissimilar than Akamian and Sarcellus. In some respects, the differences were obvious. The Knight Commander was ruthless, impatient, intolerant. His judgments were instant and irrevocable, as though he made things right simply by declaring them right. His regrets were few, and never catastrophic. In other respects, however, the differences were more subtle and more telling. Those first days after her rescue, Sarcellus had seemed utterly unfathomable to her. Though his anger was violent, expressed with the ardor of a child's tantrum and the conviction of a prophet's condemnation, he never begrudged those who angered him. Though he approached every obstacle as something to be crushed, even the inconsequential snags that filled his day-to-day administrative life, he was graceful rather than crude in his methods. Though his arrogance was feckless, he was never threatened by criticism, and more able than most to laugh at his own folly. The man had seemed a paradox, at once reprehensible and beguiling. But then she realized he was Cajaneta, a caste noble, where Suthenti, caste menials like herself and Akamian, feared others, themselves, seasons, famines, and so on. Sarcellus feared only particulars, that so-and-so might say such-and-such, that the rain might postpone the hunt. And this, she understood, changed everything. Akamian was perhaps every bit as temperamental as Sarcellus, but fear made his anger bitter, liable to spite and resentment.
He could also be arrogant, but because of fear, it seemed shrill instead of reassuring, and it certainly did not brook contradiction. Sheltered by his caste, Sarcellus had not, as the impoverished must, made fear the pivot of his passions. As a result, he possessed an immovable self-assurance. He felt, he acted, he judged. The fear of being wrong that so characterized a Commian simply did not exist for Cutius Sarcellus. Where a Commian was ignorant of the answers, Sarcellus was ignorant of the questions. No certitude, she thought, could be greater. But Esmonette had not reckoned the consequences of her scrutiny. A troubling sense of intimacy followed upon her understanding. When his questions, his banter, even his lovemaking had made it clear he wanted more than peaches to sweeten the road to Momum, she found herself secretly watching him with his men, daydreaming, wondering. Of course, she found many things about him intolerable, his dismissiveness, his capacity for cruelty. Despite his gallantry, he often spoke to her the way a herdsman would use his crook, continually correcting her when her thoughts strayed. But once she understood the origin of these tendencies, she began to see them more as traits belonging to his kind than as failings. What lions kill, she had thought, they do not murder, and what nobles take, they do not steal. She found herself feeling something she could not describe, at least not at first, something she had never felt before, and she felt it more in his arms than anywhere else. Days passed before she understood. She felt safe. This had been no small revelation. Before realizing this, she had feared she was falling in love with Sarcellus, and for a short time, the love she bore a Commian had actually seemed a lie, the infatuation of a cloistered girl for a worldly man. While she marveled at the comfort she felt in Sarcellus's embrace, she found herself pondering the desperation of her feelings for a Commian. The one seemed right and the other wrong. Should not love feel right? No, she had realized. The gods punished such love with horrors, with dead daughters. But she could not tell Sarcellus this. He would never understand. Unlike a Commian.
You love him, the Knight Commander repeated dully. That I believe, Esme, that I accept. But does he love you? Can he love you?
She frowned.
Why couldn't he?
Because he's a sorcerer.
A schoolman, for Sejanus's sake.
You think I care that he's damned?
No, of course not. He replied softly, as though trying to be gentle with hard truths. I say this, Esme, because schoolmen cannot love. Mandate schoolmen least of all.
Enough, Sarcellus. You know nothing of what you speak.
Really? He said, a pained sneer in his voice. Tell me, what part do you play in his delusions, hm?
What do you mean?
You're his tether, Esme. He's fastened on you because you bind him to what's real. But if you go to him, cast away your life and go to him, you'll simply be one of two ships at sea. Soon, very soon, you'll lose sight of shore. His madness will engulf you. You'll awaken to find his fingers about your throat, the name of someone long, long dead ringing in you. I said enough, Sarcellus!
He stared at her.
You believe him, don't you?
Believe what?
All that madness they prattle about. The consult, the second apocalypse.
Esmonette pursed her lips, said nothing. Where did this shame come from?
He nodded slowly. I see. No matter. I'll not fault you for it. You've spent much time with him. But there's one last thing I would have you consider.
Her eyes burned when she blinked. What?
You do know that wives, even mistresses, are forbidden mandate schoolmen.
She felt cold, ached as though someone had pressed freezing iron against her heart. She cleared her throat.
Yes. So you know, he licked his lips. Know the most you could ever be.
She looked at him with hate. Is his whore, Sarcellus? And what am I to you?
He knelt before her, scooped her hands into his own. He tugged on them gently.
Sooner or later, He will be recalled, Esme. He'll be forced to leave you behind.
She looked to the fire. Tears traced burning lines across her cheeks.
I know.
On his knees, the Knight Commander saw a tear lingering on her upper lip. A miniature replica of the fire glittered within it. He blinked, glimpsed himself fucking the mouth of her severed head. The thing called Sarcellus smiled.
But I press you, he said. I apologize, Esme. I just want you to see, not to suffer.
No matter, she said softly, avoiding his look. But her hands tightened about his own. He freed his fingers and gently clutched her knees. He thought of her cunny, pressed tight and greasy between her legs, and shivered with hunger. To simply be where the architect had been, to thrust where he had thrusted. It at once humbled and engorged, to plunge into a furnace stoked by the old father. He pressed himself to his feet. Come, he said, turning to the pavilion. He saw blood and grunting rapture.
No, Sarcellus, she said. I must think.
He shrugged, smiled wanly.
When you can, then.
He looked to Eritka and Hansa, his two slave girls, and with a gesture bid them to keep watch. Then he left Esmanet and strode through the flaps of the Knight Commander's pavilion. He cackled under his breath, thinking of the things he would do to her. He hardened against his breeches. The limbs of his face shuddered in delectation. Such poetry he would cut into her. The lanterns burned low, cast an orange gloom through the pavilion study. He reclined on cushions set before a low table covered in scrolls. He ran his wrist down his flat stomach, clasped his cock's aching length.
Soon. Soon.
Ah, yes, a small voice said. The promise of release.
A breath, as though drawn through a reed.
I stand among your makers, and yet the genius of your manufacture still moves me to incredulity.
Architect,
the thing called Sarcellus gasped.
Father, you would risk this? What if someone sees your mark?
One bruise does not show among many.
There was a flutter of wings and a dry click as a crow alighted on the table. A bald human head rolled on its neck as though working out kinks.
Any who sends me, the palm-sized face explained, will dismiss my mark. The scarlet schoolmen are everywhere.
Is it time? The thing called Sarcellus asked. Has the time come?
A smile, no bigger than the curl of a toenail.
Soon, Mayengi, soon.
A wing unfolded and reached out, drawing a line across Sarcellus's chest. Sarcellus's head snapped to the side. His limbs popped rigid. From his crotch to his extremities, rapture galloped across his skin, searing rapture.
So she stays?
The synthese asked.
She does not run to him?
The wingtip continued its lazy caresses. The thing called Sarcellus gasped.
For now?
Has she mentioned her night with me? Told you anything?
No, nothing.
And yet she acts open, as though she shares everything.
Yes, old father.
As I suspected.
Tiny scowl.
She's far more than the simple whore I took her to be, Mayengi. She's a student of the game.
The scowl became a smile.
A 12-talent whore, after all.
Should I?
Mayengi felt a deep pulse between his rectum and the root of his phallus, so close.
Should I kill her?
He arched against the agonizing wingtip.
Please, father, please.
No. She does not run to Drusus Akamian, which means something. Her life's been too hard for her not to weigh loyalties against advantages. She may yet prove useful.
The wingtip withdrew, was folded into glossy black. Tiny lids closed, then opened over glass bead eyes. Mayengi drew a shuddering breath. Without thinking, he cupped his phallus in his right hand, began rubbing its head with his thumb.
What of Adyersus? he asked breathlessly.
Do they suspect anything?
The Mandate know nothing. They merely send a fool on a fool's errand.
He relaxed his grip, swallowed.
I'm no longer so sure Drusus Akarmin is a fool, old father.
Why?
After delivering the Shrier's message to Gotian, I met with Geortha.
The small face grimaced.
You met with him? Did I sanction this?
No, but the whore asked me to find Akarmin for her, and I knew Geortha had been assigned to watch him.
The small head bent from side to side.
I fear my patience fails me, Mayengi.
The thing called Sarcellus pressed sweaty palms down his vestments.
Drusus Akarmin spotted Geortha following him.
He what?
In the Kamposia market. But the fool knows nothing, old father, nothing. Geortha was able to shift skins.
The synthes hopped to the mahogany lip of the table. Though it seemed as light as hollow bones and bundled papyrus, it bore the intimation of something immense, as if a leviathan rolled through waters at right angles to everywhere. Light bled from its eyes.
How? Oh, roared through what passed for Mayengi's soul. I hate,
shattering whatever thoughts, whatever passions he might call his own,
this world.
Crushing even the unquenchable hunger, the all-encompassing ache, eyes like twin nails of heaven, laughter wild with a thousand years of madness.
Show me, Mayengi.
Wings fanned before him, blotting the lanterns, leaving only a small white face against black, a frail mouthpiece for something terrible, mountainous.
Show me your true face.
The thing called Sarcellus sensed the fist of his expression slacken, then part, like Esmanet's legs. It was spring, and once again the network of fields and groves surrounding Momum were crowded by Enrithi, far better armed and far more dangerous than those who had perished in Gadea. Tidings of the slaughter on the plains of Mengeta had hung like a pall for many days over the Holy War.
How could it be? They asked.
But the apprehension was quickly stifled by rumors of Kalmamunus's arrogance, by reports of his refusal to obey Mathanet's summons. Defy Mathanet? They wondered at such folly, and the priests reminded them of the difficulty of the path, of the trials that would break them if they strayed. And there was much talk of the emperor's impious contest with the great names as well. With the exception of the Aenonai, all the great names had refused to sign the indenture, and about the evening fires, there were many drunken debates as to what their leaders should do. Far and away, most cursed the emperor, and some few even suggested that the Holy War should storm Momum and seize the supplies that would be needed to march. But some others took the emperor's side. What was the indenture, they asked, but a mere scrap of paper? And look, they said, at the dividends of signing. Not only would the men of the Tusk find themselves painlessly provisioned, they would be ensured the guidance of Icuri Confess as well, the greatest military intellect in generations. And if the destruction of the vulgar holy war was not evidence enough, what of the Shrya, who would neither force the emperor to provision the holy war, nor force the great names to sign his indenture? Why would Mathanet hesitate so, if he too did not fear the might of the heathen? But how could one fret when the very heavens shivered with their might? Such a congregation! Who could imagine that such potentates would take up the Tusk, and far more besides? Priests, not merely of the thousand temples, but from every cult, representing every aspect of God, had clamored from the beaches or wound down from the hills to take their place in the holy war, singing hymns, clashing cymbals, making the air bitter with incense and the noise of adulation. Idols were anointed with oils and attar of rose, and the priestesses of Gira made love to calloused warriors. Narcotics were reverently circulated and sipped, and the shakers cried rapturously from the dust. Demons were cast out. The purification of the holy war began. The men of the Tusk would gather after the ceremonies, swap wild rumors, or speculate about the degeneracy of the heathen. They would joke that Skyelt's wife had to be more mannish than Kefiramuni, or that the Nansor were given to receiving one another up the ass, which was why they always marched in such tight formations. They would bully malingering slaves or howl at women carrying baskets of laundry up from the River Phaeus, and out of habit, they would scowl at the strange groups of foreigners who endlessly prowled the encampment. So many. Such glory.